Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from Next Gen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. You can discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can always find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And if you register or sign up for our newsletter there, you can choose from a variety of free ebooks. And if you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, then please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. In this series, C.S. Lewis expert Professor Alistair McGrath is delving into the Space Trilogy, arguably one of Lewis's lesser-known works of fiction. We'll be exploring the three books in the trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength. Alistair, let's turn our attention to the planet Malacandra. Did he come up with those names for the planets such as Malacandra and Perelandra sort of completely from his imagination? Or do we know if they were inspired by anything in particular?
Well, Lewis really seems to draw on his own resources here. I mean, he talks about the language called Old Solar. And he, in effect, explains to us what each of these planets mean. For example, Earth is Thulacandra, which is the silent planet, hence the name of the book. I think Lewis really is doing here what we see him doing elsewhere, which is inventing new names to lead to a sense of credibility about these imaginary worlds he's constructing. Lewis wasn't as good at this as Tolkien was. Tolkien actually really, in creating names for new worlds, almost, if you like, helps us to imagine their backstory. We don't really find that in Lewis to quite the same extent. So I'm not quite sure how much we read into the names of these planets, other than to say that Lewis seems to have a thought-through understanding of what each of them is.
You mentioned the language there. I mean, is that completely fictional or is that based on anything in particular?
Well, Tolkien, who was a philologist, clearly drew on existing languages to invent his own imagined languages. Lewis seems to me really just to, not necessarily to make these things up, but to be quite... eclectic in the way in which he invents his own languages. So I don't think we should read too much into this.
And do you think it's significant that Lewis waits until near the end of the book to reveal which planet Malacandra is? Is that one of his sort of literary inventions again?
I think it's the idea of postponement, that to make a narrative more interesting, you postpone certain of its core elements. For example, who exactly is this person who's telling the story? What is this planet? I mean, we are in effect told that it is a planet. We are introduced to it, but we're in effect left with the impression this is a distant planet. There's no relevance to us at all. And then, as the narrative proceeds, we begin to realize actually we can see where this is going. This is relevant, and this is now clear. And we can begin to make the connections Lewis wants us to make.
Now, Ransom, when he gets onto the planet Malacandra, it sort of differs so much from his expectations. Is Lewis making a kind of deeper theological or philosophical point about that, do you think?
I think Lewis is making some points about our expectations and where they come from. And I think in many ways he's trying to get us to critique our expectations, our intuitions about the way things ought to be. For example, Ransom doesn't really expect Malacandra to be a particularly nice place. And then he finds it to be actually really rather nice. And again, he has expectations about the life forms, various things like that. And again, they aren't quite as he expects. So I think where Ransom simply says, oh, I've got to change my mind about these things, Weston is rather different. Weston is, in effect, saying, I want these things to be the way they ought to be, and I'm going to change them. I think what Lewis is trying to do is to get us to see that people are taking different approaches here, one of which is a sort of naive, oh, I wasn't expecting that. The other is, I don't like this, I'm going to change it, because we need it to be like this if we're going to survive here. So it's a quite a helpful way of opening up these questions about the way in which you respond to natural environments.
One of the things that I guess is quite surprising when you sort of read the book is that Ransom escapes from Weston and Divine almost as soon as they've landed on the planet. I mean, why does he feel safer with the Malacandrians, who he really knows nothing about except that they're perhaps may want a human sacrifice, than with his fellow men? And I guess significantly, is Lewis trying to tell us something about this decision that Ransom is making?
I think that the decision is really unexplained, that it's almost like an intuition. This isn't right, I'm going there. So if you like, maybe Lewis is bringing home to us that sometimes we make these intuitive judgments. I don't trust this person, but these people seem okay. And I think it's one of those things where, in effect, what Lewis is trying to do is to say, really, Ransom is making an intuitive judgment about these two people who, remember, he's been with as they travel. They abducted him, really. And the key point is that Lewis feels that these other people might well be safer, more trustworthy than the guys he knows. So I think you can see there is a sort of a framework there that may explain this move with his part. But I think the deep intuition is these guys have got something in mind for me, and I don't think it's very nice. So I've got to make my break while I still can.
And obviously along his journey, again, we won't give away too much of this story, but he meets various different life forms on Malacandra. Are those life forms particularly significant? And do you think any of this was inspired by something in particular? Do they represent anything in Lewis's mind, do you think?
I'm sure that you can map the forms of life he encounters with what he would have known well from Renaissance literature, which very often did speculate about these things. And of course, it might be a bit like Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe is a classic account of someone arriving on a strange island, and you've no idea what's there, and you're evaluating everything you find to try and place it. Is it safe? Is it edible? Is it dangerous? You know, and maybe Lewis is, in effect, almost reworking Robinson Crusoe's narrative on Malacandra. But I think there is something going on here, which is, if I can put this, Ransom's intuitive judgment. There's this form of life which seems to be lower, and this form which seems to be rational and hence higher. And in effect saying, really, you know, that's the way it looks to me. Is it really like that, or is that me making that judgment? I think that's an important point, that Lewis recognizes that there's certain life forms he finds it easier to relate to. But wonders whether that says something about the life form or about him.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. Thank you for your support.
Well, yeah, because that's a really interesting thing, isn't it? Is this distinction between rational and non-rational beings an important one for Lewis? And how does he unpack that in this novel?
Well, in this novel, he unpacks it in a number of ways. One is by looking at the way in which these life forms relate to each other. The other is the way in which he relates to these life forms. And I think the narrative kind of way really, really gives you a deeper picture of the complexity of the situation and Lewis and Ransom's growing realization that he's perhaps made some bad initial calls and needs to revise them. But I think it does feed very easily into a question we touched on earlier, which is the whole issue of vivisection, that Lewis in many ways, you know, was very familiar with the justification of vivisection because it meant using lower life forms to help understand how higher life forms could flourish and benefit. And I think one of the conclusions Lewis came to was that we can't make this judgment, that actually if we are a higher life form, we owe it to lower life forms to really respect them and help them to flourish. And I think you can see something similar going on here, that we tend to make rather condescending and self-centered judgments about other life forms. And Lewis is just saying, let's just pause here and ask whether it's quite as straightforward as we think.
So do you think Lewis was sort of assuming an intellectual hierarchy of humanity over some of this extraterrestrial life?
I think that Lewis himself believed in what you might call a great chain of being, which is everything is interconnected, that everything has its right place. And therefore, although humanity is actually pretty much at the top of that particular tree, everything else is interconnected. And therefore, you have to learn to respect every element of the bigger picture. Weston takes a very different view, which is we're the top of the tree and we are the ones that really matter. Never we can exploit everybody else for our own particular ends. So what Lewis is getting at here, I think, is you need a bigger picture to help you realize that the simple view we're at the top, everything else is exploitable. Actually, that's not good enough. We it's not that simple. And Lewis is trying to say the Christian doctrine of creation is really not about exploiting creation, but about having to look after it because we have been placed on top of it because we are responsible and accountable. It's not about humanity being omnipotent. It's about we have responsibilities towards those that are lower down the scale than we are.
Alistair, the way that Lewis describes Ransom's first encounter with one of the Malachandran creatures, a hross, if that's how you pronounce it, might sound strange to modern ears. This is what it says. It was foolish, frightening, ecstatic, and unbearable all in one moment. It was more than curiosity. It was like a courtship, like the meeting of the first man and the first woman in the world. It was like something beyond that. So natural is the contact of sexes, so limited the strangeness, so shallow the reticence, so mild the repugnance to be overcome compared with the first tingling intercourse of two different but rational species. What do you think Lewis is trying to convey here? Does he purposefully use words that seem to be reminiscent of sexual attraction, do you think, Alistair?
Well, he's clearly picking up on the Genesis creation narratives. And he is trying to get across the idea that there's some kind of attraction or mystique or something, which in effect means Ransom feels drawn to this. And Lewis's language is saying, I can't really put my finger on precisely what this is, but it seems natural, it just seems okay. And the way he phrases it, you know, that he uses words like strange or reticent, and in effect, it's all about overcoming barriers. But I think the point that Lewis is bringing out here is that barriers are relatively easily overcome if you are drawn to something or someone. Now, Lewis is, I think, beginning to tease out the question, what is it about human beings that means we are drawn to something else? Is it for sexual purposes, or is it because, in effect, we feel here is a kindred spirit who actually we can relate to and thus live in harmony with and try and find a way of relating to them which is appropriate to our own distinct identities? So it seems to me it's quite a rich passage that opens up some very helpful discussions.
And Ransom has quite an interesting conversation with the Hrossa about love and sex, doesn't he? I mean, are these concepts purely fictional, or was he sort of basing some of that conversation on existing ideas at his time, like during his time?
Well, during the 1920s, there were some who said that sex was simply a means of reproducing, and therefore it was something that was done only when necessary. And I think what's happening here is that Lewis is, how shall I put it, trying to tease out what it is about the way in which we are drawn to or relate to other people, other creatures, and what purpose and outcome is. And clearly, Lewis isn't really advocating some kind of interspecies interaction. It's something deeper. It's almost as if Ransom feels he belongs here, that he can have some sort of relationship with these creatures, even though they are different. And it feels like a form of attraction he already is familiar with, but it doesn't seem to be appropriate here, and yet it's happening. It's sort of, I'm drawn to this. There's something about this that makes me feel part of this. And really, I think it's all about Ransom's growing sense of these creatures really matter. They're important. And therefore, in effect, setting him very much on a different trajectory than Weston, who basically completely disregards them and sees them only as an impediment to the survival of the human species.
And one of the things they talk about in that discussion is that they perhaps, the Hrossa, is that how you say it, Hrossa?
I'm guessing.
Who knows? They only seem to have sex in 1 or 2 years of their life, and then the pleasure is completed by kind of remembering that, and it sort of grows over the years. I mean, is that something that would have been a concept that Lewis was drawing on, or again, is that just entirely fictional?
I think that this is fictional. Remember, Lewis made that point very, very clearly. But there were some rather exotic people who took views similar to that. That in effect, at 1 or 2 points, D.H. Lawrence talks about, in effect, the sex in the mind, where you simply recall something like that to actually do anything. So it may be that Lewis is picking up on something that was in the wider culture at the time.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And do register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.